What a pleasure it is to be with James Carse. Dr. James Carse, you have for more than 30 years led the religious studies work at New York University, NYU, as a professor of the history and philosophy of religion, right?
Right.
Ooh, see, I've said it before.
A very heavy title.
But it's important because it says that for many, many years you've been thinking about both history and philosophy of religion.
Right.
Which gets us to the religion part that we sort of invited ourselves into the ideas about belief and about science. Let's go to the religion part per se. I'll give you a provocative question. How do you put boundaries around religion?
Well, let's discuss boundaries for a moment. A boundary always marks a place of opposition. One might even say hostility. We are, to use a very simple example, right now extremely conscious of our boundary with Mexico because there are a lot of issues. But most people can't even find the boundary with Canada. You can walk back and forth across that boundary over 3,000 miles without any indication where it is. We don't care. There are no issues with Canada. It's almost as though we don't have a boundary. Now, what that means is boundaries get stronger as the opposition gets stronger. So that if you want to keep a clear boundary around your belief system, one of the things you definitely want to do is stimulate opposition. That's one of the reasons why arguments with believers have the wonderful effect of strengthening people's belief. You never win an argument with a believer. You just convince them.
I'll testify to that.
Yeah, right. It's pretty clear. But so religion operates very differently, and I'll use another metaphor, the metaphor of horizon, which I'm sure you thought I would get to here.
I hope so.
Yeah, horizon is a different kind of a phenomenon completely, where, think of it like this, no matter where you are, you have a horizon. The horizon is not a line you could walk to and point out like a boundary, but is only the end of your vision. Now, what that means is anytime you move, your vision, that edge of your vision changes. And so a horizon is always relative to our own adventuring, really, is the way to put it.
Which brings us to a scary word when you say relative to. You are very careful time and again to say this does not, your way of thinking and your approach to a religious case against belief is neither relativistic nor nihilistic.
No, true.
And I think neither. Both of those are important to say early on, that you're not saying anything goes.
Oh, no. Now, that tells us something about religion, about belief, the notion of a boundary, a belief system with strong authority and very strong ideas about what you don't believe. I mean, most believers are just as eager to tell you what they don't believe is what they do. But religion, let's approach it like this. Take today, let's look at the poor Episcopalians breaking up over the issue of homosexuality. It's as though that issue for those people defines what Christianity is. Well, we can go back in history, any historian could do this, or any literate layman, and see hundreds of belief systems that developed out of Christianity. Not one of them captured Christianity. Christianity is something that never is defined by any of these believers. In fact, to put it a little more vividly, from the beginning, even the disciples with Jesus were confused about what we're supposed to believe. I mean, what's really going on here? They didn't know. They didn't get it. Well, they asked Jesus, and he said, well, love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Well, that didn't quite do it. Then Paul wrestled with these issues and so on. It goes through the New Testament in various ways. And then the great moment was the creation of what we now know as the Apostles' Creed, which was, we don't know the origin of it, but obviously what it was established to do was to mark the outer edge of what you should not believe, or the, you know, where you your believing should stop.
And
where
this
you thinking.
Was way later.
Oh, this was, we're now well into the second century. We don't know, the dates are also obscure. But the Apostles' Creed didn't do it. Then later, other creeds were suggested. Then finally, we got to the Nicene Creed, which was convened by Constantine in the year 320, at a conference in 325. That tried to, again, form limits to what we can think. Actually, what's most interesting about the Nicene Creed, which I'm sure is quoted, cited in most Christian religious services, is that every phrase of it has a negative element. Everything mm-hmm. is what you should believe, but it's aimed at what you shouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. So to a historian, it's rather comical. It was a way of dealing with heresies, not with a truth on the inside.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a tax code.
I don't mean to trivialize it, but
it's that kind of thinking that
metaphor. Yeah.
You can tell how people have been cheating.
As deeply
yeah, that's
reactive.
Right. That's very, very nice. Point.
Deeply reactive.
Yeah, right. Oh, completely reactive. And negative, really, in every sense. Protective, reactive. Well, a few years ago, a scholar at Yale, Yaroslav Pelikan, published a book long awaited by Christian theologians, a five-volume study of Christian creeds, of the major Christian creeds. I counted them up. There are 211 in his book. So, you know, what
not,
this tells
not
us...
Not one of which was about homosexuality.
No, right. Homosexuality doesn't occur. We'll need a new one for that now, of course.
Well, is it... But, I'm sorry?
Yeah, I just wanted to finish this thought that Christians have never agreed on what's... That we are as puzzled about what Christianity is as Jesus' disciples were.
That is an open system.
Yeah, really.
As I think most people would, for the first time I saw the Horizon piece and the word that came from that, I was reading horizontal.
Oh,
As opposed to horizontal, and once I made that transition, it sort of recalibrated how I thought about it. We have a friend we were talking about earlier, Stuart Kaufman, who talks about the adjacent possible, and has in fact built a science.
And he's borrowed that term from chemistry.
Out of chemistry, yeah. You know, he's talking about reaction steps. But it seems to be precisely what you're talking, or very close to, or at least a close analog of this boundary condition that, and I want to be clear for all of us that the belief systems don't go outside the boundaries.
Oh yes, that's right.
And part of their power, and we'll come back to that, I hope, is the internal consistency. Everything supports everything else.
Right.
As long as there are no incursions, as mm-hmm. long as you don't acknowledge that there is any possibility outside that system.
Right.
That's the way it is. So when we say closed system, we mean really closed. Any ventilation into that is an existential threat.
Oh, blocking
the
whole.
It's a heresy.
Yeah, right.
We're talking about this in religious terms that, well, in terms of faith systems, can I say it that way? But you talk about belief systems or ideologies that originate elsewhere as well. So this isn't just, if I may respectfully say, God talk. You use other examples of belief systems or ideologies. And I must say, as I was reading along and came on Nazism, Maoism, Serbian nationalism, and American triumphalism.
Right. Those are all big belief systems. And one of the points I want to make in the book is that belief systems are inherently dangerous. Not only do they form out of opposition, but their need to have opposition, it creates a great havoc. Hitler's ideology made no sense apart from its notion of being deeply persecuted by the rest of the world. Not just Jews, the Jewish bankers is the way I like to talk about it, but everyone, the whole non-Aryan world, as if Aryan was something. But
so the notion of conflict is important to it. They feed on conflict.
But also important in this sense that Hitler not only needed that opposition, he needed to create it. I mean, Nazism made no sense without armies at the door. Or to use a simpler example, patriots, people who love the flag, really need an opposing patriot, as it were. I mean, the only way patriotism makes sense is to have another patriotism over here with whom you're... In other words, patriotism has within it a really strong self-contradiction.
Well, but patriotism as a belief system.
Right.
There may be a patriotism that... That goes. That
yeah, there's a love of country or something that's like that.
Not
that.
Yeah. But what I'm, again, part of the genius of this is I, as other people I'm sure have done, I am a threat to attack some of these belief systems. And and what the lesson you taught me out of this is not only am I not going to succeed, I am feeding the beast.
Yes.
And in fact, their very existence, their ongoing existence
requires
opposition, whether it's from me or somebody else.
No, it falls apart.
So the best thing I can do is ignore them. Right.
No, the best treatment of belief systems is indifference. And one of the best example of that, I mean, in a way, it's an awesome example, is what happened with Soviet Marxism. It finally lost its appeal, primarily to the young, but eventually to everyone. No one believed it any longer. And it wasn't even, they didn't even care about it. And it wasn't as though they were arguing with it, which would have, really strengthened the system. It just didn't come up. They if someone talked about Marxism with the Soviet youth in the later part of the 20th century, it would have just fallen dead. So that worked in a way that no great ideological failure has ever worked in human history. Amazing.
The Religious Case Against Belief is one of many books that James P. Carse has graced us and the world with, which we're going to be back in just a moment with him here in Western Massachusetts. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, the three of us invite you to be with us when we return.